You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. And it is day one of the government back in business. Right? 16 days, 30 minutes. That's how long the government was shut down. Delayed salaries, $3,048,000,000. WIC benefits that went unpaid and probably will never be paid, $210 million. 2,033,000 civilian employees laid off. 883,000 federal employees furloughed. Now, the federal employees are going to get their back pay, but the 2 million private sector employees are going to get nothing. It's amazing. Rachel Maddow on her show last night put together a great graphic. There's a picture of it up over on Democratic Underground and over on, I think, Huffington Post. It's floating around the internet, and it deserves credit. I mean, I'm telling you where it came from because it's like somebody put some work into adding all this up. This is what at various times the Republicans wanted in exchange for simply keeping the government that George Washington had three horses shot out from under him to create. The government that James Madison ran back into the White House, actually his wife, Dolly, ran back into the White House as it was on fire in the War of 1812 and recovered the picture of George Washington. And James Madison became the first and only sitting president to go out and lead troops in battle. The government that Abraham Lincoln ultimately gave his life for, along with about 600,000 other Americans in the war of northern aggression, as they say down south. The government that Franklin Roosevelt helped patch back together step by step. The government that Jack Kennedy died trying to govern. The government that everybody thought was a good idea until Ronald Reagan came along and in his first inaugural address said, the government is the problem. And ever since then, there's been this small group of anti-American crazies who hate our government. Our government that all these people over all these years, the people who fought in World War II, people who fought in World War I, the people who fought in the Civil War, at least for the North, the people who fought in the Revolutionary War, the people who fought in the War of 1812, our government that they fought to keep, and many of them died. Our government, according to these teabaggers, has become an evil thing. Or was all along, actually. I mean, it was George Washington who signed the first legislation that provided housing, food, medical care, and clothing to poor people in Washington, D.C., George Washington, first welfare program. But somehow, the teabagger caucus, Tea Party caucus, excuse me. Don't mean to be casting aspersions on these people. The Tea Party caucus, they don't know that, I don't think. I don't think that they understand that these are the traditional American values. They want the government to be completely uninvolved in housing people, in feeding people, in healing people who are sick, in providing unemployment benefits for people. It was the George Washington administration that started this. Thomas Jefferson felt that the biggest accomplishment, he was, you will recall, the guy who wrote the Declaration of Independence, harassed James Madison to the point that we got the Bill of Rights. I mean, literally, go back and read their correspondence. Was the third president of the United States, the first secretary of state, the third president of the United States. He was vice president of the United States, the second vice president of the United States, the third president of the United States. But he felt that it was, that the thing that he did that was the most important. Now, don't tell any Tea Partiers this. It'll make their heads explode. Thomas Jefferson designed his own tombstone. You can find it. You can probably find it online without too much trouble. His original notes. He designed it. I've been there. It's there. Right over at Monticello. He designed his own tombstone, and he wrote his own epitaph, his own obituary, the words on his tombstone. And it says on there that he's the author of the Declaration of Independence, the author of the Virginia Declaration of Religious Liberty, as I recall. I'm doing this from memory, but it may have a slightly different name. And the founder of the University of Virginia, the first free college in the United States. He did not even want on his tombstone that he was president, not because he was ashamed of it, but because he felt that these things were more important. He birthed this country, and then he gave us our first free college. Abraham Lincoln took it a step beyond that. He said, you know, free college is so important, and we've got a lot of federal land stolen from the Indians, but hey, we got a lot of federal land. Let's give big chunks of it to the various states. There's over 50 of them. I mean, there weren't even 50 states back then, but over 50 land-grant colleges. Let's give big chunks of land that are large enough that the college can work the land. They can mine the lumber. Or they can, in the case of Michigan State University, where I briefly went to school, they still have the cow barns and things there. I mean, it's a huge agricultural college. You can run a farm, sell the produce, take the money and pay for kids to go to college so that college can be free for students all across the country. And it was from the time of Abraham Lincoln until Ronald Reagan became governor of California and said, enough of this, these free college, these kids without, they're not paying tuition, to hell with them. We're going to start jacking up the tuition. Well, what he literally said was, why should I be paying the tuition for students who are protesting me and my policies? Well, Ronnie, you weren't paying it. I mean, you were governor, but it was the people of the state of California who were paying it. But Reagan changed that, and then when he became president, ask anybody, those of you who are under 40, ask anybody who's over 60 or over 55 what it cost to go to college back in the 60s or the 50s or the 40s. My mother went to college at Michigan State University in the late 1940s. She graduated magna cum laude. She went to college, and she paid for it with a part-time job in the summer in Charlevoix, Michigan, as a lifeguard, and a weekend job at the Lansing Airport, washing airplanes and propping planes for people. She paid for college with a part-time job. I went to college for a while. I didn't graduate, unlike my mother. But when I went to college, I paid for it I worked at a gas station, I worked at Bob's Big Boy, and I worked as a DJ at WITL. None of those jobs made over $3 an hour. You could pay for college back then. I mean, people didn't even know about college then. Don't tell that to the Tea Partiers. They brought this government to its knees. This government, this government of Washington and Jefferson and Lincoln and Kennedy and frankly Eisenhower, a great Republican. They brought this government to its knees and cost us $24 billion for what? Because they don't want 46 million people who don't have health insurance to be able to get it? They brought this government to its knees because they object to the idea that people who have had, like my friend Tommy Christopher, who had a heart attack and can't get health insurance, that, hey, screw him, he shouldn't be able to get health insurance. They really did this. Do you get this? These people are, they're like over the edge.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Screaming about Freemasons and I mean, it's really gotten wild here. And I haven't even yet gotten to the list that Rachel Maddow put together that's posted over at DU. I will do that after this break. But right now, Nate Sweet, producer with The Big Picture, is on the line with us. Hey, Nate.
Hey, how's it going, Tom?
Great. Great to see you. Okay, we're going to start out with Mike Papantonio. He's going to be with us here on the radio show in the next hour. So
Yeah, I can't wait to hear what Pap has to say. I'm sure he will have a lot to talk about in the wake of this shutdown.
Oh, his head has to be exploding.
Yeah, we already, I consider to guess based on his responses to other things Republicans have done in the past that he's going to be past his boiling point on the show tonight. So definitely going to be an exciting segment for all your viewers to check out.
Yeah, it should be a lot of fun. And then, just for the fun of it, well, not just for the fun of it, actually.
For the good of it.
For the what?
For the debate, for the good of it.
So people can learn what these guys are really thinking. And I'm assuming, Nate, you heard part of my rant just then.
Yeah.
And that's kind of the frame I want to put this conversation in. Rusty Humphries is going to be with us. And Adam
Thompson is going to be
here. Adam Thompson.
Yeah.
Two Tea Partiers.
Yep.
Rusty is a conservative talk show host. He's been on the program before. He's been on my radio program before. I'm not sure he's ever been on the TV show.
Yeah, he has. He's been
here
for a couple debates before.
Okay. Oh yeah. In fact, he was in the studio. That's
right.
Him and Scotty. Yeah, Scotty. Scotty was his producer, or used to be. And so anyhow, Rusty and Adam are going to come on, and they're going to explain to us the Tea Party world, the Tea Party perspective, why they think this was a good thing, and that is going to be fascinating.
We're going to play Ted Cruz psychiatrist here.
I'm really looking forward to this. I mean, I got to tell you, it's like, you know, you're thinking, what? Really?
Yeah. It's really inexplicable. I mean, you hear the arguments and you hear the talking points, but, you know, getting a chance to, you know, look at the whole framework through which they view the world, I think is a chance you don't want to miss, because it's probably even more shocking than you can imagine.
Well, and I think it's important that people, you know, I was talking yesterday on the radio program here about how siloized our society has become. You know, people who watch Fox only watch Fox. People who watch, you know, Free Speech TV or MSNBC only watch those networks. And even I've noticed, you know, Louise, because she produces the programs, when she's on the New York Times site, she's often looking at stories that are the kind of stories right-wingers would watch or read. And I'm just reading the stuff that, as a progressive, I'm interested in, because I'm not thinking of producing a show, and she's thinking of guests. And when we look at the New York Times app on our phones and we look at the, you know, recommended for you and most read, the lists are actually different. We're sitting right next to each other with, you know, and we're both logged on to the exact same app on the exact same website for the exact same newspaper, and we're seeing different lists of articles, and hers skew to the right and mine skew to the left. And it's like, we are all living in these little silos. So I think it's really important to pop out of the silo from time to time. And we're going to do that tonight with these guys.
Yeah, it's sort of one of those situations where the more you read, the less you know.
Yeah.
And hopefully we'll try to avoid that with that little debate. And
there you go.
Really debate, a back and forth segment tonight.
Yeah. And then Geeky Science and our Daily Take.
Yeah, Geeky Science are going to be talking about the important role plants have played in keeping the Earth's carbon levels stable throughout its history, and the role deforestation is playing in encouraging carbon levels to increase.
Yeah.
Daily Take is about the media's role in essentially not really telling the American people the truth about the shutdown.
Yep, absolutely. Nate Sweet, producer with The Big Picture. Thanks, Nate.
Thanks, Tom.
We'll be back. It's 20 minutes past the hour. Welcome back. Occupying the Media, 3 hours a day, 5 days a week. Tom Harbin here with you. Okay, I started out my rant in the beginning of the show saying that Rachel Maddow had posted this cool thing on her show last night, and which I missed, but because Louise and I actually were out to dinner with a couple who had donated to Free Speech TV, and sometimes when we do fund drives for Free Speech TV or for the New England Salem Children's Village, salemchildrensvillage.org, with a $1,000 donation, we say, I'll buy you dinner if you come to town. Well, we did that last night. It was very nice. We met some really interesting people. What Rachel did show on her show, she said, this is what the Republicans asked for. I'll just go through this list. And once again, I'm saying, you know, please don't tell these Tea Partiers, you know, because their heads will explode. Don't tell them that George Washington gave free health care to poor people. This is before Obamacare. This is before Medicaid. This is before Medicare. This was George Washington, the first president of the United States. Don't tell them that George Washington gave free food to poor people. Well, Congress did, actually. George Washington signed the bill. Don't tell them that the first Congress, which was made up of a whole lot of people who fought in the American Revolution and helped write the Constitution, that the first Congress appropriated money for poor people here in Washington, D.C. to have medical care, food, and a place to live. Free shelter. Don't tell them that Abraham Lincoln created the first nationwide network of free colleges. Don't tell them that Dwight Eisenhower campaigned in 1956 on the fact that in the previous 4 years he had expanded Social Security, added the Social Security disability thing to it, increased the number of people eligible for Social Security. Well, for that matter, Ronald Reagan in 1984 campaigned on having strengthened Social Security. Look it up. Don't tell these guys this. They don't know, and they don't want to know. They are really happy in their ignorance. So anyway, here's the things that the Republicans demanded in exchange for shutting down the government. They wanted to defund Obamacare. They wanted to delay Obamacare. They wanted to delay the individual mandate. They wanted to deny coverage to the president. Oh, isn't that brilliant? They wanted to deny coverage to the cabinet. Yes, let's make that black guy in the White House, let's make him sweat and the people who work with him. How dare they? Don't they know it's not supposed to be like that? They showed up last week with a Confederate flag. You know what the Confederacy was all about, right? Stood in front of the White House. Cheered on. Ted Cruz and Sarah Palin and the whole... Oh, it's incredible. Anyhow, they wanted to deny coverage to the cabinet. They wanted to deny coverage to congressional staffers. Ted and Sarah weren't standing there with a Confederate flag. It was one of the guys who was part of the crowd, just for clarification, please. You know. Anyway. They wanted to deny birth control coverage. Is this new study out, by the way? It's in our newscast. That it turns out that when women have access to birth control, it doesn't just help women. They space their children out in ways that they can afford to both, you know, raise them and feed them and all that kind of thing, but also in terms of time, be there for their kids. And the consequence of that is that the children are more likely to graduate from high school. They're more likely to graduate from college. They're more likely to have a high income. They're more likely to have stable marriages. They're more likely to have good health. All those things come about because mom had access to birth control. Well, the Tea Partiers wanted to deny birth control coverage in exchange for not shutting down the government. They wanted to approve the Keystone Pipeline. Yes, let's bring this really cruddy oil. It's not even oil. It's ground up kind of coal slurry, bitumen. I always thought bitumen was just called coal. There's bituminous coal and anthracite coal, right, if I'm remembering my sixth grade science correctly. This is bitumen. This is a variation on bituminous coal that is mixed up with water and weird petroleum products and pumped down this pipeline all the way to the Gulf Coast so that the Koch brothers can refine it, make a profit on it, and then sell the gasoline and diesel fuel to China. Now, the Tea Partiers wanted to make sure that that got approved, the Keystone Pipeline. They wanted means testing for Medicare. We can't have anybody over 65 have access to medical services, cheap medical services or free medical services, who has any money at all. They wanted to change the federal employee pensions because federal employees, you know, are evil people. How dare they work for the government? That government is a bad thing. Ronald Reagan told us so. Forget that Dwight Eisenhower led the invasion of Europe to stop Hitler and fought World War II. Republican Dwight Eisenhower to defend our government. They wanted to change federal employee pensions. They wanted to expand oil drilling. Yes, because it's so nice to be on the brink of global extinction. LastHours.org. They wanted to block net neutrality. They wanted to block net neutrality, really? They were shutting the government down over making sure that Comcast can basically decide who gets to see what and charge you know, based on what you're looking at and or what you want to put out on the web. Really? They wanted to shut the government down over tort reform. In other words, your life is only worth $250,000. You can't sue for any more than that. If somebody cripples you or kills you, produces a product that disables you, that's it. No more than $250,000. They wanted that. They wanted to weaken the regulations for coal-fired power plants. Oh, let's have more cancers. They wanted to change the tax code. Lower taxes for billionaires, you know. They wanted to stop the EPA coal ash regulations. Back to coal-fired power plants. You can tell who's paying the paycheck for these Tea Party Republicans. They wanted to repeal the medical device tax. They wanted to change the rules on the debt ceiling. And what did they get? Well, Rachel says they got nothing. Actually, what they got was, well, nothing. They think they got another bite at the apple. We'll talk about that after the break.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
And we'll pick up your calls. I'm curious your thoughts on and reflections on what's happened over the last couple of weeks. Good, the bad, and the very, very charismatically ugly. Brought to you by the Organic Wine Company, EcoWine.com. The good, the people of Cilicia. Energy giant Chevron wants to start fracking in their hometown, but the residents of this eastern Romanian village are having none of it. Hundreds of people have been camping out at a drill site since Monday night, preventing construction vehicles from entering. Others have formed human chains surrounding exploration wells and clashed with police when they tried to break the chains. Earlier today, Chevron announced that it is suspending its fracking plans in the wake of the ongoing protests. Good work, people of Cilicia. Tag, you're it. The bad. Ann Coulter. In a recent column published on her website, the conservative pundit made a startling claim about Obamacare. She said that no doctors who went to an American medical school will be accepting Obamacare. Well, this is one of the most ridiculous things Anne has ever written, and that's saying something. In reality, there is no such thing as accepting Obamacare. Obamacare is just a reform of the private health insurance system, which American-trained doctors already participate in. So, yes, as long as American-trained doctors accept insurance, they will be accepting Obamacare. Anyone like Ann Coulter who says otherwise is just woefully misinformed or flat-out lying. And the very, very ugly Ted Nugent. During a recent appearance on the radio station Gator 98.7, the rock star turned right-wing crusader warned that he's so frustrated by President Obama that he's seriously considering a run for political office. Check it out.
The threat of me running for public office is alive and well because obviously our government has been overtaken by gangsters and America haters. I mean, we have a liar for a president. That being said, I would love to see America run like the Nugent household.
Yeah, you know, I can't think of anything worse than a President Nugent. That's very, very ugly. That's incredible. It's just incredible. Well, I have, actually, considerably more that I wanted to rant about. For example, the $24 billion that this little caucus of Republicans just cost us. According to Standard and Poor's, this is not, you know, the liberals, this is the, you know, S&P. $24 billion is what it cost us. Cost to our economy. That's, you know, that the entire year's Department of Agriculture budget is only $22 billion. The entire year's NASA budget is only $16 billion. This thing just cost us $24 billion. The cost of all air transportation programs, including the FAA, security, research, the whole thing, $21 billion. This cost us $24. The child tax credit, $22 billion. Welfare, they now call it, you know, since Bill Clinton did away with welfare as we know it, they now call it temporary assistance for needy families, and it is temporary. The entire welfare program, $17 billion. The Republicans just cost us $24 billion, and Fox News and all the right-wing commentators are saying, yeah, it's nothing. It's just a drop in the bucket. But we can't afford to have welfare. Head Start, the entire Head Start program, plus the CHIP program, the Children's Health Insurance program, the entire Children's Health Insurance program for the whole country, plus the WIC programs, the Women, Infants, and Children's program, together are $25 billion. Well, we can't afford those, but we can shut down the government and cost us $24 billion. It's just a drop in the bucket. Doesn't mean anything. Mark in Elmwood Park, Illinois. Hey, Mark, what's up?
Yeah, hi, Tom.
Hey, Mark, if you got me on a speakerphone, it sounds like you're in the bottom of a 50-gallon oil drum.
I apologize. Hey, I'm sorry to bring this up.
It still sounds like you're on a speakerphone.
I mean, no, I'm not on a speakerphone anymore.
Huh, okay.
I'm in an empty room.
Oh, okay.
Oh, I'm sorry to bring this up. But I know I'm kind of like what the Republicans want for people to get disgusted. But I just am just frustrated that Obama doesn't seem to rise to the level of articulating how radical these maneuvers are. But the Republicans are doing.
Did you see his speech today? He just totally kicked their butts. I'm sorry, Mark. I strongly disagree with you. I think that, you know, President Obama, the mistake that he made 2 years ago when the Republicans did the same thing, when they said, okay, we're going to hold the country hostage and we're going to shoot the hostage, you know, if you don't go along with us. And they came within a day or so of it. And I don't know if it was S&P or it was one of the rating agencies downgraded us and all, you know, the stock market started to fall and everything freaked out. And the mistake that he made was that was the time when John Boehner said words to the effect of, I got what I wanted.
And when you look at this final agreement that we came to with the White House, you know, I got 98% of what I wanted. I'm pretty happy.
That was the sequester. So for 2 years, we've had this sequester, and it gets worse every year. It's going to get even worse either December 15th or January 15th. I think December 15th, just in time for Christmas. More people get laid off. So, you know, the last time, 2 years ago, he blinked, and he said, okay, I'll give you the sequester. He didn't believe that they would actually use it. The sequester kicks in if the Republicans won't pass a budget. And in March of this year, the Senate passed a budget, sent it down to the Republicans in the House of Representatives, and John Boehner said, nope, I'm not going to appoint a conference committee. We are not going to negotiate a budget. So we got the sequester. We got Boehner's sequester. So they got some serious blood last time. They thought they were going to this time. They got bupkis this time. So I'm not buying that one, Mark. Bruce in Alberton, Montana. Hey, Bruce.
Hey, I'm from a red state that has a Democratic governor, and we still don't get Medicaid.
Ouch.
That's an
aside. Is it because your state legislature blocked it?
Yep.
Yeah.
We have a Republican legislature.
Yeah.
But I'd also like to give another name to the corporations that suck the lifeblood out of their employees and the government. And that's Suck.
Okay.
So it's
Suck up, capitalism?
Suck up cash capitalism.
Suck up
cash.
Uh-huh. Oh, I see. You're making an acronym out of it. Okay. Bruce, a good one. I'll add it to the list. I've got it somewhere around here. It's on this cluttered desk. I've got a pile of names that people. Yesterday we were trying to come up with names for what is this kind of capitalism and thank you for the call, Bruce. What is the name for this kind of capitalism where you have the American fast food industry making $7 billion in profits and we subsidize them to the tune of $3.8 billion? You have the average Walmart apparently costing about $1 million a year, excuse me, to the local community in terms of subsidies. What do you call that kind of capitalism? That's a good question. Bill in East Stroudsburg, Pennsylvania. Hey, Bill, what's up?
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me on.
Sure.
I have a few myself. Whenever I speak to people or write an op-ed for my union or anything like that, I always refer to it as the CEO, the corporate elite oligarchy. And I think they sponsor Capone corporatism.
Capone.
The insider trading on Wall Street is Siphonomics. Citizens United is Satanomics. And the privatized gains and socialized losses is wealthcare capitalism, or capital totalitarianism, or however it's pronounced.
Capital totalitarianism? Yeah.
Oh, you could say it. I can't.
Yeah. Good ones, Bill. Good ones. Okay, great. That's a great list. Thank you for calling and sharing that with us. Ben in Albuquerque, New Mexico, listening on 1350 AM. Hey, Ben, what's up?
Hey, thanks for having me on, Tom. You got a great program.
Thank you.
Well, it just seems to me that what the Republicans have been wanting to do and succeeding at every turn is striking blows against the economy, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because in the end, in 2016, that's the main thing is they're going to run on is, well, the economy is down, you know? And so in that sense, I mean, if they shaved off a half a percent of GDP and cost nearly a million jobs, they struck a major blow against the economy. And, you know, got just what they wanted. So, I mean, I think they really succeeded in that sense.
And you go back to that initial meeting on January 20th, 2009, here at the Caucus Room restaurant, where Paul Ryan and Jeb Henseling and Pete Sessions and John Kyle and all these other Republicans, what's his name, who runs the Heritage Foundation next door, Jim DeMint. And all these guys got together and basically swore a blood oath to each other. You know, Pete Sessions later said they were going to become the Taliban insurgency to destroy the Obama presidency. Jim DeMint said they were going to break the president. Now the New York Times pointed out that this current shutdown was planned several months ago in another similar, you know, meeting in a restaurant by a group of Republicans. And they actually planned this thing exactly the way it played out. They planned the thing in advance. And yeah, they did damage the president. They did damage our economy, which does, you know, it hurts the Obama presidency to be president during a time of bad economy. You're right. Ben, thanks for the call. I mean, this is what it's all about. Inflict pain on the American people so you can say, see, look who's president. It's his fault. This is the game they're playing. And they're trying to say somehow that the government of the United States is not the United States. Like, you know what? The government of China is not China? Really?
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
So anyhow, you've heard my thoughts on this. Your thoughts are next. It's 15 minutes before. Welcome back. And let's see here. Natalie in Great Falls, Montana. Hey, Natalie, you have another name for this kind of capitalism, huh?
I do. O period I-N-C. Oink.
O-I-N-K?
O period I-N-C, as incorporated.
Oh.
Oink.
O-ink. Oink. Yeah. Oink. Yeah, because they're like pigs.
That's it.
Yeah. Okay, that's a great one, Natalie. Thank you very much for the call, and thanks for sharing that with us. Leonard in Ridgelwood, North Carolina, is that right?
Regalwood, North Carolina.
Regalwood. Thank you very much. What's up?
Hi, how you doing, Tom? I enjoy the show very much.
Thank you.
I just wanted to comment on the people's obsession with the government. And I think the average voter, especially Republicans that are against government, have no idea why, other than the misinformation effect. I believe corporations are behind this massive effort. And the reason big business pushes this is because of regulations that restrict them from putting profits ahead of people.
You're right.
Putting profits ahead of people. These regulations were created after the Great Depression as protection for the people against the economy ever collapsing again, and worked fine until presidents from Reagan to Bush pushed deregulation, and we almost had another Great Depression ending with today's economy.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right, Leonard, and very well said. Absolutely right. Thank you very much for that call, and thank you for the comment. Joanne in Truth or Consequences, New Mexico. Hey, Joanne, what's up?
Hi, Tom. It is so good to talk to you.
Well, thank you. And thanks for watching Free Speech TV.
And thank you. Please bear with me. I'm a stroke victim. I'm 76 years old, but I still have my brain. Mm-hmm. I don't have my speech very good.
Uh-huh.
But I do want what you're saying about this president is a shame. One time I voted Republican, I never vote Republican again. This morning I had CNN on, and Wolf Blitzer said the president was lecturing to the Republicans. They can stand up and call him a liar and a skunk and everything else, and I never hear Wolf Blitzer or anybody else say anything about that.
Yeah.
It's not right. Mm. I was born in the South. You don't get any more Southern than Chattanooga, Tennessee. I know what game these people are playing. It's because he's a black man. They don't look at his character. They don't look at his policies. I don't like what's happening in this country, but I don't believe it can be saved at this point.
I think it can, Joanne. I think we've got to drop another notch or two to wake everybody up, and I think that's probably going to happen in the next few years. But I think that this country has incredible resilience. We made it through the Civil War. We made it through the War of 1812. We made it through the World War I, World War II. We've been to hell and back, this country, several times. And I think we're going to come back again. I really do. So I share your perspective, and I thank you for your comments. I think you're absolutely right on. I'm just, I guess, a little bit more optimistic about you, about the country than you are. And we'll all see, right? Joanne, thank you for the call. Thank you so much. Great to hear from you. We'll be right back.
You know that you're wrong, but you fear you're right. You suspect you're out of sync.
You think that you're out of your mind.
Everything you know is wrong.
And sometimes, you know what you know, and sometimes you don't know what you know, and sometimes you know what you don't know. And anyhow, so what do you know about the number 12? William Gladstone has a new novel out. It's called The Power of 12. 12, the book, 12thebook.com is the website. And, Bill, welcome to the program.
Great to be back on your show, Tom. I'm holding up a copy of the book just so those who have the video can see it, The Power of 12. Very excited about this new book, and it is really ideal for your audience because I share a lot of the concerns that you air on your show, and even though it's a novel and it's fun and it's got great characters and a lot of humor in it, it really does address some of these bigger themes. Are we headed for doom? The Mayan themselves did not say we were headed for doom. The way our politicians behave, I think we might be. But we have the opportunity, according to indigenous prophecies, not just from the Mayans, but to actually create a world that works for everyone that is better than what we've experienced today. But there's got to be a lot of change, and I agree with what you just said to your last caller. Things may get a lot worse before they get better, but we are resilient, and we have the resources to really make a difference. And what The Power of 12 is really about is, in a fictional way, how people themselves, just by their own thoughts and activities and by connecting and using the technology we have today, can raise the issues that really matter and sort of bypass the existing economic and political systems to create a world that really works for all 7 billion of us.
We are talking with William Gladstone. His book, The Power of 12thebook.com, 12thebook.com is the website. And, of course, the book is available anywhere and everywhere, and if you can't get it at your local bookstore, ask for it, or your local library. Bill, what is the... You said there are things that we can do and that you talk about in your novel to make this a better world, to make it a sustainable world.
The very first thing is just education and awareness. We need... I mean, you've written about this in some of your books. We've created an education system that trains people to be workers in corporations, and the corporations exist for the benefit of a few thousand, maybe tens of thousands of families, and not the world as a whole. And we just need to bring awareness to people that they have within their own unique gifts the ability to be creative and to find work that is meaningful and that is not just make work to satisfy the needs of these large corporations, which exist really for one purpose only, which is to make money and satisfy the owners of those corporations with larger and larger profits.
Yeah.
There are some exceptions. The world is starting to change, and the changes are coming not because some, you know, benevolent dictator at a major corporation decided it was good for the corporation to start paying attention to the needs of the environment and the needs of the social community, but because the social community itself started putting pressure either with their pocketbook by choosing to frequent companies that did take community into account rather than companies that didn't. So we, the people, really do have a lot of power, much more than we've ever had before. And though it may seem that we don't, as wealth has become concentrated in the hands of fewer and fewer people, we really can make a difference. And it's kind of like with the falling of the Berlin Wall. For decades, it seemed impossible. But then when it finally happened, it happened almost effortlessly, it seemed, and very quickly. And yeah. I predict that similar kinds of changes can happen even today.
Yeah, I don't disagree. In fact, I think that these kinds of transitions happen really fast. Like, you know, I've been for a long time saying we should amend the Constitution to say that corporations aren't people and money is not speech.
Mm-hmm.
And people say, oh, there's been 29,000 attempts to amend the Constitution. Some constitutional amendments have taken 70 years. And I say, yeah, and the one to reduce the voting age down to 18 was introduced in March and was ratified in August of the same year. I mean, it is when the public is pregnant with change, when the times are pregnant with change, that birth, I mean, childbirth is a pretty instantaneous process compared to 9 months of gestation. And,
well, I think you're making a great point there, Tom. And the whole point of my novels, both The 12 and The Power of 12, is really to capture indigenous wisdom and present it in a comfortable way for the modern person. I mean, in The Power of 12, I make a lot of fun of George Bush. I actually have met him. You know, I never agreed with his politics, but he's not a terrible human being, though he's done some terrible things. A lot of the problems that we have had to endure is not because people are evil, but because they are following paradigms which really have outlived their purpose. The whole economic system of capitalism is wonderful, but it was never intended to create multi-billionaires. No one really needs billions of dollars to live a satisfying life. And we need to start thinking, and, you know, for that matter, no one intended our government to have budgets of trillions of dollars and, you know, create all these special interests which are in complete conflict with the real purpose of government. So we've got a lot of problems to solve, and it may just be that the way to solve them is by sidestepping them and not trying to solve them directly, but creating something new and effective. And whether that's through non-governmental organizations or just grassroots movements, I don't know. I'm not a political analyst. I'm not even a sociologist. But I know that there is something going on. And it's not just me. I've studied indigenous people. They have been predicting this large change for centuries. And I think we're in the middle of it. And the Mayan calendar, from a mathematical point of view, was the most accurate calendar that has ever been created. And we're finding out more and more details about how that calendar is related to specific physical phenomena, including the wobble and the rotation of our planet, which has a 26,000-year cycle identical to the Mayan calendar period that just ended. So there's a lot of mystery going on right now, but there's also a lot of hope.
Yeah, yeah. And we are on the knife edge, you know, really in some ways. At lasthours.org, we've got a video up about, you know, how we could be looking at extinction. And then on the other hand, you know, if the entire world adopted just a very modest carbon tax, we could be, the entire planet could be carbon free within a decade or two. I mean, within a generation.
Well, and this is one of the premises of my novel, The Power of 12, is I have this, the Illuminati, and I'm not saying the Illuminati actually exists, but I create this character, Arnold Wheeler Dealer, who's the grand light and keeper of the code for the Illuminati. And he's fulfilling what he thinks is his mission, which is that only the Illuminati should be in charge, and GMO and everything else. But the reality is, you can change the structure very quickly. Hydrogen, other alternative fuels come up.
Yeah, Bill, we're you're fading out. We're out of time.
Okay.
But Bill Gladstone, William Gladstone, 12 the book, 12thebook.com. It's the book is The Power of 12. Thank you, Bill.
Thank you, Tom.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey, friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters: EdisonFactor.com. Edison Factor is a supplement for the brain. More information at EdisonFactor.com. SolarWorld.com. SolarWorld has a 35-year history in the manufacturing of solar in America. More information at SolarWorld.com. Carbonite.com. Automatic online backup and file recovery. More information at Carbonite.com. AngiesList.com. Detailed reviews on roofers, plumbers, house cleaners, dentists, and more. More information at AngiesList.com. Stamps.com. Postage online from your computer. More information at Stamps.com. And our website, TomHartmann.com. You support our programs, and please help by supporting the people who help make this program possible. There are links to all of our underwriters at TomHartmann.com. Thank you.
You're listening to the Tom Hartmann Program.
And welcome back. Tom Hartmann here with you. And we have 60 seconds. Is that? Okay. All right. We will. Just an FYI, Free Speech TV, I believe, Free Speech TV wrapped up their fund drive last week. I know some of our stations are still having fundraising drives right now. WBAI, I'm not sure if KBCS is, KPFK, but if you're listening on a station that is having a fundraising drive, that is in the process, please support our nonprofit stations. And also, we have a new video up that is over. It's over at lasthours.org about this very real problem, this very, very real problem of climate change leading to the possibility of actually wiping out life on Earth. So check it out. Take it seriously. And all that said, Mike Papantonio is on the line with us. RingofFireRadio.com is the website. Attorney and host of Ring of Fire Radio and Ring of Fire TV on Free Speech TV. Hey, Pap, how you doing?
Tom, how you doing?
I'm great.
Good.
I'm great. I am guessing, we were talking this morning in our show prep meeting, that your head has been exploding over the last few days just watching what's going on. I'm just, what do you think about these people who just, you know, cost us $24 billion, took all that money away from women and infants and children and blah, blah, blah. Yeah, I mean, it's just...
Well, Republicans have lost five times in the last six presidential cycles, and this doesn't help them anymore. One thing I hope the Democrats do this time, I call it humiliation rehabilitation, and that is where you spike the ball in the end zone, you dance in the end zone, and you say, you know what, get used to this, you're going to see more. But unfortunately, the Democrats, for the most part, are trying to be politically correct about it. We can't upset the teabag Republicans, which is nonsense. Although I did see Obama come out and say, you know, if you want to stop Obamacare, go out and win your own election, which that's what we have to do. And I tell you that it's what I tell young lawyers to do, Tom. Mm-hmm. And that is when you win against an opponent that you're going to have to go to trial with again and again, you want to let them know you've won. You want to reiterate that you've won, and you want to make it a part of the culture, your culture of winning. Democrats have been very bad about doing that. They seem to be falling into the same thing right now. And rather than getting out and saying, you know what, you bunch of cuckoos, put yourself here. You lost five elections out of the last six presidential elections, and we now have a new mantra, and that is pushback. So I think that's the message I'd like to see out there as a practical matter, knowing Democratic leadership, we probably won't. But I think it's an important message because what it does is it continues this motivates this notion of we can win if we push back.
Yeah. And five out of the last six presidential elections, didn't George Bush win twice?
Yeah, you know.
Or are you saying he didn't win the first time?
Yeah, well, exactly. I guess that's the way to look at it.
I mean, he really didn't.
Yeah.
In fact, if his brother hadn't knocked 80,000 African Americans off the voting rolls, there wouldn't have even been a doubt to take to the Supreme Court.
Well, at any rate, it's a message. You can't squander $24 billion and cost the American public 900 1,000 jobs and expect anything good to come out of it. But the problem is, Tom, we're working with a Congress that is, it's an animal we've never seen before. I was taking a look. I don't know if you saw this Sunlight Foundation that did a fairly extensive study, and they tried to find out what's happening to Congress as far as the dumbed-down factor. Mm-hmm. And they found out that the members of Congress, freshman Republican that came in this last go-around, are speaking at the lowest grade level in the history of Congress.
Really?
In other words,
it's not just Louie Gohmert.
Yeah, we're moving into uncharted territory where the leadership has been dumbed down so much in order to appeal to the gerrymandered, crazyville kind of dumbed down voters that they're speaking like them. They become them rather than showing leadership. It's like, I guess, the equivalent, Tom, of having a 2-year-old who says, you know, I just want to eat candy. I don't want to eat anything but candy. And mom and dad, you got to feed me candy, rather than mom and dad saying to the brat child, no, you're going to eat real food. You're going to actually live like you're supposed to live because I'm your parent. We're going to show leadership. Well, these dumbed down kind of congressmen that led us through this travesty, this disaster that's cost America so much money, when you look at the numbers about their ability to communicate, lowest it's ever been.
Well, and they're not just saying, I only want to eat candy. They're saying, I only want to eat candy, and if you don't let me, I'm going to burn the house down.
Yes. Yes. That's very well put.
I mean,
that's very well put. So it's something we've never seen before. I mean, I don't know how else to put it. I mean, stupid sells, and stupid sells especially when you have gerrymandered the voters that you want into stupidville.
Pap, as a colleague in the media, I would like your thoughts on this comment. This is my take on this whole thing. If the mainstream media, if the corporate media had actually told America on day one of the hostage taking that John Boehner had a clean CR, and if he put it before the entire House of Representatives, it would have passed. We know that. 20 Republicans were on the record saying, I'd vote for it. Only took 17. If the media had simply said that on day one and said it loudly and clearly and said it day after day, this thing would not have lasted more than 2 or 3 days. But the media made hundreds of millions of dollars in increased ad revenue because of the spectacle.
Right.
Your thoughts?
Tom, they couldn't lead us into a war in Syria. The media was actually trying to be part of that.
Oh, yeah.
They couldn't get us embroiled in a war in Syria like they did in Iraq. The media couldn't make money that way. So they left out really a big part of the story. Although, you know, Boehner's easy to attack, but look what Boehner's been suffering from. He's been suffering from these cuckoo teabagger Republicans that he has to confront every day. Had they told the story, Boehner was solidly behind it. If you look at the history, Reid had to come out and say, wait a second, why isn't the media talking about the fact that Boehner had a deal with me? It was a clean deal. We had it all worked out. And instead, they focused on Cruz. They helped Cruz raise $2 million for his campaign. They helped the new Joe McCarthy become that new image that people like to watch because they're so damn crazy. And so it was, you hit it on the head, it was another failure of corporate media. There is no mainstream media anymore, Tom.
Yeah.
The best media they get is from people like you. It's not from corporate media anymore. It was a scam that they pulled on the American public by not telling the truth.
Yeah, and it's a real tragedy. And I track this back to Reagan stopping enforcing the Sherman Act, so we had this media monopoly. Reagan stopping the Fairness Doctrine, so there's no longer an obligation to inform people, and then Clinton signing the Telecommunications Act. So we go from real news to infotainment.
Tom, when you and I started this, when I started this business, at least, there were 50 independent organizations that ran the media. Now it's 4. I'm talking about all of the major parts of media.
Yeah.
I mean, the major parts, whether it's radio, television, magazines, newspapers, it's bundled up into 4 or 5 major corporations, and you don't have diversity that would have told the story that you're talking about right now, that would have avoided this stand down that was taking place, because at some point the Republicans were saying, oh, gee, this is good for us. Our crazies back home in Stupidville that we've gerrymandered into Stupidville, they really like this. So let me get on the platform and talk about it some more. That was Ted Cruz completely.
Yeah. Amazing. Mike Papantonio, check it out. Ring of Fire Radio every weekend on the radio. Ring of Fire TV every weekend on Free Speech TV. You can find times and dates and stations and all that kind of stuff over at ringoffireradio.com. Pap, you're doing a great job. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks a lot, Tom.
We'll be right back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
That's ringoffireradio.com. In fact, I'll be a guest on Ring of Fire Radio this weekend. So, Pap, welcome back. Let's talk about Ring of Fire TV this weekend.
Yeah, Rick Outson's going to join me to talk about the Obama administration's hostility towards the press. Probably a lot of good reasons for that, but nevertheless, it is something that seems to be developing and has developed for a while. Richard Eskow for the Campaign for America's Future is going to talk about the price of Republican policies. What does it really cost you to have the kind of craziness that took place in the last couple of weeks, well beyond that? Attorney Dave Tissell, Howard Nations, they're going to talk about the extremist groups that are pulling the strings for John Boehner, forcing Boehner to do the things he has to do. Ari Berman, GOP's plan to redistrict the South and how it's working for them real well. Farron Cousins from Trial Lawyer Magazine, he's going to talk about the new reports that link income inequality to the dumbing down of America. It's a pretty interesting lineup.
Wow. Sounds like a great show. I'm curious just, you know, how your any further thoughts on Crazyville? I mean, you pretty much laid it out there, but you know, we got a couple minutes here, and
I don't know if you saw one thing that really paints this picture. I took a look at some of the quotes. This is what this when this organization, Sunlight Foundation, when they explored how stupid have these new gerrymandered congressmen become. How about this quote? We're not going to be disrespected. We have to get something out of all this. And, you know, right now, I don't even know what it is, but we want something. That was Marlon Stutzman, a Republican from Indiana. Michelle Bachmann, we're very excited. This is exactly what we wanted to happen. This is good for America. Michelle Bachmann, this is my idea of fun. This is a Republican representative, Dave Schwelkler is his name, from Arizona. Or how about this? This is Representative John Culberson. I said, it's just like 9/11, so let's roll. Now, these are people that have been elected to office. How about this? This thing that I have to do, well, you have to understand, I need my paycheck. That's the bottom line. That's all I really care about. So you have these, Steve King. How about Steve King? We shut the government down to unleash human nature. What in the hell does that mean?
That's a good question.
You know, this is the caliber of crazy that we have been gerrymandered into. You know what, Tom? This doesn't change until 2020.
You know,
strap in. 144 votes, every one of them, they're never going to be changed. You're not going to change these Republican teabaggers.
Yeah. This weekend I had an opportunity to talk with a fairly interesting group of people, and among them was a former lieutenant governor of Iowa. And she pointed out that state now, they have a way of drawing congressional districts that it is done by computer. The congressional districts are polygons, you know, even sides. All sides are relatively even, as much as can be done. And that if the legislature doesn't like it, they have two tries to ratify it. And if they don't ultimately take it, it gets thrown to the state Supreme Court.
Yeah.
And as a result of that, there are no gerrymandered districts in Iowa any longer. And that's a cool idea. We need to take that thing, you know, now.
Well, as you've pointed out, Tom, the teabag Republicans can't do that. This is their last chance. This is their last breath. You wrote an excellent article that the teabaggers are dead. I mean, it's history.
Yeah.
They still want to hang on as long as they can with gerrymandering. It's the last chance they have to be significant, relevant at all.
And they're blowing it. I think you're right. Mike Papantonio, be sure and check out Ring of Fire TV Sunday at noon, and then it replays throughout the week here on Free Speech TV and ringoffireradio.com as well. Pap, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you, Tom.
It's always, always a pleasure. Always. We'll be right back. Think about this. If you were standing in the midst of an extinction, Is it possible you could be completely unaware of it? Underground, underwater, and below the ice, a time bomb is ticking. Scientists are seeing the evidence. Runaway climate change could be closer than we think. Go to lasthours.org and share the video with your friends now to help get this important message out right away. Welcome back. Tom Herman here with you. It's 20 minutes past the hour. And did Ted Cruz really grow up in a cult? I haven't seen this in the news. Somebody forwarded it to me in email, and you always have to, you know. And I haven't, frankly, since I got it, haven't had the time to go digging. Louise and I, after we get off the TV show last night, we went out to dinner with this couple, and then we got home and just fell into bed because I had to get up early this morning to go see the dentist. And you know how those things go. It's just been one of those insane weeks, but. I got this that Ted Cruz's dad was just one of these real out there kind of preacher types. I don't know. I'm going to have to look into it and find out. But Bruce in Auburn, one of the things I saw a preview of the new Julian Assange movie. It's called The Fifth Estate. It's going to be released, I think, next week. It's coming out. And in that movie, they talk about how Julian Assange grew up in a cult where everybody bleached their hair. All the kids had to bleach their hair. And that he was still, I thought, well, that's interesting. You get these little kind of human insights. It's actually a brilliant, brilliant movie. Anyhow, Bruce in Auburn, Washington, listening on KBCS. Hey, Bruce, what's up?
Not much, Tom. How you doing today?
Great.
Okay, here's my thoughts on this. We better beware because my observations is that the Republican Party only gets it wrong once. You saw Nixon. Okay, they got him. Then Oliver North wasn't having that. They went away. They got together, and they made sure they got the lie straight. Just like these guys, after Obama got elected, went to the caucus room, you know, and they went to that doggone Mexican restaurant with all of their weirdos friends.
Mm-hmm.
These guys are not about to not have a fight next time. And
yeah.
I don't know whether you remember.
Yeah, we should not be doing a victory dance right now. We should be organizing and getting people ready to go to the polls in November of next year.
And now, do you remember when Nancy Pelosi actually became the speaker? Remember, she says we will not do to them what they did to us by locking them out of all these. Anyway, I see John McCain say, you know, don't embarrass us. It's time to realize you're not dealing with rational people. That's all it is to it.
Well, we're dealing with bullies. We're dealing with people who have this bully mentality and an entitlement mentality, and most of them are bought and paid for. They're beholden to a small handful of very cranky billionaires who don't much like American government and, by extension, you know, traditional American values. And so I think you're right, Bruce. I think that's very well said. Thank you very much for calling and saying it. Christine in Fort Collins, Colorado. Hey, Christine.
Hi, Tom. I wanted to just address a right-wing meme that I'm starting to see out there, and I don't know if you've talked about it before, but when we're talking about the fact that Obama, it seems that the deficit has been cut in half,
right.
And that number seems to, you know, a lot of people don't realize it, first of all, that that's what has been going on. But I'm seeing people making remarks that the only reason that the deficit has gone so low is because of the sequester. So in other words, right. They're saying Obama shouldn't be being given any credit for having, you know, cutting in half.
Right, and yet when you trash talk the sequester, they say
that did it. Go ahead.
When you trash talk the sequester in a debate with a Republican, they immediately say, oh, but that was Obama's idea. And then I say, but then, you know, Boehner said that he got 99% of what he wanted, and Obama was just throwing it out as a crazy idea. But the reality is that the deficit has been going down, not because of the sequester, although the sequester has reduced government spending slightly.
Right.
It actually it's reduced the rate of the growth of government spending. So it hasn't cut government spending itself. But what's happened is that, you know, federal revenues are going up because the economy's been picking back up. So tax collections are up.
I've been trying to look up and figure out, you know, where can I find the numbers prior to the sequester of how the deficit, you know, how much it was going down and at what rate it was going down, and then to extrapolate on that where it would have been if the sequester didn't happen. How does one, or could somebody in the chat room, can one of the whiz kids in the chat room, you know, figure that out?
You'll have to drop into the chat room and see what they come up with. Which, by the way, is free, and, you know, it's just easy over at TomHartman.com.
I go in there every so often.
Oh, great,
so,
great.
You know,
yeah.
I was just hoping somebody could had this already on top of their, on top of their head, because this is what I'm starting to see in some arguments I'm having with people on Facebook and stuff like that, going, oh, Obama's taking credit for, the deficit going down, but it's really the sequester that did it to begin with. And I just wanted to try and figure out, where can I get numbers, prior to...
You might want to go over to the Economic Policy Institute's website, EPI, which I think is epi.org, but if you, put Economic Policy Institute into duckduckgo.com or, your favorite search engine, it'll get you there. That's Dean, what's Dean's last name? Anyway, that's his website. He's a really, really good economist. And there, maybe over at the Think Progress website, you might be able to ask those questions. And, of course, the Department of the Treasury has statistics online. The Department of Labor has statistics online. But it's, sometimes finding those statistics and going through and parsing them and taking the numbers out, you get these giant spreadsheets that are just, like, unfathomable to normal people that...
Right. Yeah. If I had, Paul Krugman's brain, then I'd be able to make sense of it. But I don't.
Yeah. No. The rest of us don't have PhDs in economics, nor do we have Nobel prizes. So it's.
Right.
Yeah. But I'm guessing that as that meme gets hold, and I've heard it too, Christine, that you will see the pushback on that, and particularly you're going to see the pushback on that as we come up to December 15th, because on December 15th. The sequester takes another bite out of our economy, legislatively, by law. And so I think the Democrats are going to start pushing back on this really hard, really soon. And they need to be. Christine, thanks a lot for bringing that up. I appreciate it. 28 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
What do you think would be the very best strategy for the Democrats to take moving forward? Minutes past the hour. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with me is Peter Morici, a conservative economist and professor at the University of Maryland, Robert H. Smith School of Business, contributor to Newsmax, newsmax.com. His Twitter account is P. Morici, that's spelled M-O-R-I-C-I, one, as in the digit one, at P. Morici, digit one. Peter, welcome.
Nice to be with you.
Thank you. You wrote a piece for Newsmax titled Obama Victory Based on Deception and Demagoguery. First of all, by the Obama victory, you're talking about the Republicans not being successful in using shutting down the government as a lever to get the president or Congress, for that matter, to defund Obamacare.
Or get anything at all. By the way, I wrote a previous column. I'm pretty well syndicated nationally by TheStreet.com, United Press International. I get published in a couple of major newspapers every week.
Okay.
Somebody picks me up, usually several. I thought they were very childish to try to defund Obamacare. They just don't have the votes. They don't have the political power. Mr. Obama won his election. The House Republicans won their election. In a lot of ways, we have a stalemate. We have sort of like a minority government in Europe, in a parliamentary system. But more broadly, they didn't get anything on the debt ceiling at all. But Mr. Obama played the debt ceiling in ways that I think is kind of reprehensible.
Well, you said President Barack Obama has resorted to falsehoods, wounded American democracy, and damaged U.S. global leadership. And what I don't understand is where in the Constitution does it say that the president is responsible for appropriating funds or raising taxes? I thought that was the sole province of the House of Representatives with the approval of the Senate. So how can you blame that on President Obama?
Let me justify what I had to say so your listeners don't think I'm a nut, okay?
Go for it.
All right. The debt ceiling, let's forget about the government closure. That was a stupid thing. Let's focus on the debt ceiling. The spending that we've done to date is already funded by the existing debt. We were not going to raise the debt ceiling to pay any bills we had already racked up. Those were paid for by taxes and what money we already borrowed. We were going to raise the debt ceiling to essentially facilitate new spending. Okay? Now, hold on. That's revenue raising, and that basically...
Well, that's not true.
That is true. Basically, we've spent that money on the money. We borrowed that money to pay for the spending we've already done.
Okay, well, here's a middle ground between that's not true and that is true. The ongoing spending that is going on is for things that Congress said we're going to pay for a period of time. You know, when George Bush authorized the war in Afghanistan, he set up a $1 trillion expenditure. The war in Iraq, $1 trillion. Now they're saying the two of them are going to cost us about $6 trillion before it's all unwound in about 30 or 40 years and the last veteran dies.
I will respond to that question, but you're going to have to let me finish my argument, all right?
All right.
Okay. The Congress, there's a difference between authorizations and appropriation. The Congress passes lots of laws, and it doesn't completely fund them. It basically passes authorizations. Appropriations are what the Congress then chooses to fund. For example, we can pass legislation to establish a Head Start program for children between 12 and 14. I'm making up something fictitious. And we can authorize spending, and the Congress does this all the time, of $500 billion a year. Let's pick a big number.
Sure.
But then it only appropriates $300 billion. In order to execute the law, it has to appropriate money. So this is new spending, okay?
But there has been no new spending.
Well,
if what you were saying was true, then there would be no need to raise the debt ceiling.
I don't choose to become involved with it. The money we have spent has been financed by the debt we have racked up. The question is how much more money will we spend? In that context, the president wants to spend more than it will come in taxes, basically $315 billion a month as opposed to the $250 billion that comes in taxes, then it's up to the House of Representatives to appropriate that money and essentially raise it. It's up to
right.
The
they can they can either raise taxes or they can
or borrowing.
Or they
okay.
can raise taxes or they can cut spending.
Or they can borrow the money. And
no, Congress doesn't do that. The executive branch in the course of the Department of the Treasury in the course of spending the money that Congress has authorized either takes it out of the revenue stream from the taxes that Congress authorized, or if it's not there, borrows it.
We're getting too deep into the weeds. It doesn't. The Congress authorizes all kinds of spending, but it only appropriates so much, and the Treasury can only spend what the Congress appropriates. So
this is all the fault of Congress. Why are you picking on President Obama for this?
You want to play word games with me?
No, this is what the Constitution says.
Okay, in order for the Congress, the president would like to continue spending $750 billion more a year than we're taking in.
But it's not his choice.
No, it does have a choice, actually. For example, in the continuing resolution that it sends over, it can choose to spend less, and that's not illegal. For example, it can appropriate less.
But the president doesn't have that choice. I mean, Article 1, Section 8, the Congress shall have the power to lay and collect taxes, duties, imposts, and excises to pay the debts and provide for the common defense and general welfare of the United States and to borrow money on the credit of the United States.
If the
Congress.
All right. Do I get to finish a thought on this show?
Sure.
I mean, I want to know, am I going to get to finish the following thought?
I don't know. How long is it?
It's not very long.
Okay.
But you are inclined to interrupt.
I am. You're right.
Okay. And when I was booked, they told me, Peter, you're a conservative. This is a liberal talk show.
Yes.
We're not going to play gotcha with me. When I host talk shows, I don't treat my liberals the way you are treating me now.
Well, I apologize if you think that
I don't really need an apology. I just need to let me finish my thought.
Okay. Go for
it. That is basically, it's up to the House of Representatives to authorize in some way, additional borrowing because we've hit the cap.
Right.
In doing that, if the House determines, gee, we're borrowing too much money, we want to renegotiate. We want to renegotiate the level of spending that we're going to have going forward. That is its prerogative in the context of raising revenues or in the context of borrowing additional money.
You're absolutely right. But they have to get the Senate to go along with that, and then the president has the power to veto it.
Right. And so if the president is going to veto what they send over, then they need to negotiate. What I'm saying is it's up to the president to negotiate with the House.
If he chooses.
And he refused to do that. And
right.
So basically what he did was he cut the House out, and he essentially negotiated with the Senate. Now, there are tricks that are available for originating a spending of this kind or borrowing of this kind, either the continuing resolution to spend or raising the debt ceiling so that it's possible to borrow more. It's possible to do that with a Senate bill. What you basically do is you take a previous House bill and strip it to the studs. You take you amend it down to zero,
right.
and you then put everything on there.
Refilling the wrapper.
The House.
Yeah.
And you basically make it a message from the other body.
Right.
And so you can then just...
Which is what happened.
Down. Now, what I'm getting at is that basically he chose not to negotiate with the House. And my feeling is that the House, the framers put the money... Was the intention of the framers that these kinds of negotiations go on between the president and the House, not a more friendly venue, for example, in this case, the president and the Senate. And that did constitutional harm. He was able to do that by misrepresenting what was going on. If we had not raised the debt ceiling, we did not need to default. We take in $250 billion a month in revenue, and we have to pay out about $23 billion a month in interest. Now, that interest payment is pretty steady. It's $23 billion every month, gradually rising as we become more indebted or falling if interest rates fall on bonds we roll over. Now, the revenue does fluctuate, but it doesn't fluctuate so much as that you wouldn't have $23 billion. It would have put the President of the United States in the position of having to set priorities. That is, he would have had $250 billion to meet $315 billion worth of obligations. So what he would have had to do, basically, is not spend some of that money. And the shutdown we had would have not been pretty. What would have happened would have not been pretty. It would have been more drastic than the shutdown.
Well, he would have had to say to people that, you know, to, for example, defense contractors who had actual contracts where the full faith and credit of the United States was pledged, we will pay you for these tanks. He would have to say to them, sorry, we're not going to pay you for these tanks. That's a default.
No, it's not. If that was a default, we already just defaulted because during the...
I think we did.
Oh, okay. So in your mind, we already defaulted.
Well, you know, if you tried to say to your banker, I'm sorry, I'm not going to pay the mortgage this month because, you know, I've just got this 2 month.
That's exactly what's happened because with the government shutdown. So we already have defaulted.
Technically, yes, absolutely.
Well, I guess, no, technically we haven't. A default, the notion of defaulting, the world worried about defaulting on the bonds.
That's the thing. I mean, we defaulted, if I may, Peter, we defaulted to the people. In other words, we said, we're going to screw the federal workers, and we're going to screw the 2 million people who depend on federal activities for their secondary income, you know, contractors and vendors near national parks. We're going to screw them. But what everybody was hysterical about is when we screw the bankers.
Well, the point is that to create chaos in global capital, you didn't see any chaos because we basically didn't pay the contractors that are building fighter jets. They essentially had to lay workers off.
That's right.
For example, my daughter was laid off. She works for a federal contractor.
Yeah, okay? She's not a bankster.
Home, and she's not going to get paid probably. I don't know what the federal workers are going to get paid, but I doubt that the workers for the contractors are. Well, there's your music, so we have to go.
Yeah, I agree with you on that point.
All right, well, listen, you have a good day.
Thank you very much for coming.
I'm at PMorici1.
There you go. PMorici1 or at PMorici1 on Twitter. And drop in and say hi to Peter. And Peter just vanished, so I can't say goodbye to him. We'll be right back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
So if you'd like to tweet to Peter, again, it's at PMorici, M-O-R-I-C-I, digit 1. Welcome back. Well, that was an interesting conversation. Dan in Spokane, Washington. Hey, Dan, what's up?
How you doing, Tom?
Just fine. Thanks for watching Free Speech TV. What's on your mind?
Yeah, thanks for taking my call. Well, my idea is on another name for this capitalism you've been talking about. A lot of the corporations seem to be more connected with the Republicans and the religious right and that part of the field rather than Democrats and, you know, and so on. So shouldn't we call it crusade capitalism?
Crusade capitalism. It's like, you know, Pope, what was it, Pope
Pius III or Pope Innocent or whoever. What was the Pope? It was Pope Innocent, wasn't it, who declared the Crusades in 1213 or something like that? 1312, whatever the year was.
Yeah, around there.
Yeah, so
Constantine that really gave it a big push when he converted to Christianity in 3.
Yeah, well, that was 1,000 years earlier, but or 800-900 years earlier. But you're right. That was the first big bump for Christianity. But my point was that the analog, the modern day analog for that Pope who declared the Crusades, is Ted Cruz.
Yeah. Right.
Right. 19 hours on the Senate with his so-called filibuster, which, you know, was staged, and Harry Reid and Mitch McConnell let him do it. And, you know, he got 2 million signatures, and he raised a couple million bucks, and he's, you know, he's riding high. He's going to be the guy. Yep. It's pretty incredible. Dan, thanks a lot for the call. That's a great one. Jennifer in Lincolnton, North Carolina. Hey, Jennifer, thanks for watching Free Speech TV.
Thanks for taking my call, Tom. First of all, I do want to say something about Ted Cruz, but first I want to say something about your little conversation with Mr. Morrissey.
Yes.
It was so funny when you bring, like all of these radical conservatives, when you bring up the Constitution and the law and reality, he says to you, oh, we're getting out in the weeds now.
Yeah,
you know,
you're playing gotcha.
Exactly. Whenever you face them with facts or refute something, it's like, oh, I don't want to go there. You know, that's not relevant.
That's an inconvenient truth.
Exactly. But what I was calling about is during this fiasco, watching Ted Cruz on television, I worked in healthcare for almost 30 years before I retired, and in mental health, and, you know, have some knowledge of that. And it ran through my mind, I think the man might have a narcissistic personality disorder.
Ted Cruz?
I don't know if
count on it.
You know, and that is a mental health condition.
Yes.
That you cannot treat.
You're right. You can't treat people with narcissistic personality disorder. You can only be very, very careful how you interact with them because they will do damage.
Exactly. Exactly.
It's the same thing as psychopathy.
Exactly.
And they're really kind of variations of each other.
Well, he stood up, but just his demeanor, his self-aggrandizement, it looked like there were some problems there. Has anybody ever looked into his background? Because I know you mentioned something about you got an email saying, was he raising a cult?
Yeah, yeah. I'm just starting to dig into it. I'm fascinated by it. But I think that you're right. I think that, you know, that Joe McCarthy analogy, I've said on the program before, the grandstanding, yes. So the real Joe McCarthy in our government, who I also think is a sociopath, is Daryl Issa in the House of Representatives. He's the guy who's, you know, doing everything he can to set up the impeachment of Obama and to destroy Hillary Clinton before she runs for president. But the clown prince, and I think you're right, the narcissist, is Ted Cruz. There's just no doubt about that in my mind. Jennifer, thank you for the call. And thanks for watching Free Speech TV in Lincolnton, North Carolina. We'll be right back. Minutes before the hour. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, and I am pleased to introduce Bob Ney, former Congressman Bob Ney, who is the author of the book on what goes on in Washington, D.C. If you want to know how this town really works, pick up a copy of Bob Ney's book, Sideswiped. Anyhow, Bob is here reporting for the Talk Radio News Service, brought to you by GoatsForTheOldGoat.com and Free-Don.org about Don Siegelman. Hey, Bob.
Hello.
So, as a former Republican member of the House of Representatives and somebody who knows John Boehner and knows a lot of these guys, at least the ones who've been around for a while, what are your thoughts on what just happened?
Well, I Twittered today he will not be Speaker in November of 2014. That's my throwing it out there for what it's worth.
Now, is that because the Republicans are not going to hold the House or because the Republicans are going to stage a revolt?
I think they're going to hold the House. They're going to lose some seats, maybe, but they're going to hold the House. This is a prediction. But he will not be Speaker. They will not put him back in.
Do you think it will be Eric Cantor?
Eric Cantor, yes. I believe he is the front runner. Something could happen, but I think Eric Cantor would be the one in waiting.
Now, in your book, in your book Sideswiped, you lay out some actual crimes that John Boehner was involved in. You're naming names, and you've said you're willing to go before a grand jury and name names, give the testimony.
Do you think that once he no longer has the protection of the speakership, that he might find himself in a Tom DeLay position looking at jail time?
Somebody might do something, or they might file a charge next year while he's in office with the Ethics Committee, which would bring out everything, you know, and there's a process. But I think with, you know, what he did, Tom, and this is what's the weirdest thing of all, this is the biggest loss of all for him. What he did is he did something he could have done 16 days ago. He gained nothing in this entire process. I mean, zero in it. They restated something that's already in Obamacare about verifying income. That's in existence. And it's a restatement of what they have. That's not going to be accepted by anybody in the Tea Party. He opened the vote. But he changed the rules that only Eric Cantor could actually pull something from the desk, which was the Senate report, to reopen the government. But I'm just not sure who on earth the Speaker tried to appease. So public policy-wise, they kicked the can down the road till two dates. One was, you know, the 15th of January for the shutdown again, possibly. And the other is February 7th for the debt ceiling. Right. So there was nothing gained, Tom. I mean, nothing. If they would have got some budget numbers.
They've got now December 15th and January 7th as the new looming deadlines, and already some of these Tea Party guys are saying, oh boy, we're going to take another bite at this apple. What do you think?
Well, the president knows that Boehner blinks.
Mm-hmm.
Knowing that the president knows that Boehner blinks, which he does, whether one agrees with it or not, he said not going to negotiate, and then he blinked. So the president knows this. So what are they going to do? Go back up to the 11th hour again? What will Boehner do? He doesn't want to be the speaker that defaults on the debt as leader of, quote, this country, as the Speaker of the House. He doesn't want to be that man in history.
Right.
And the president knows this. So I think that's why the president came out, in my opinion, kind of hit them with a ball bat. Nancy Pelosi took it and just slapped them all around.
Yes.
About how much money was lost, $24 billion some dollars, et cetera.
Yeah.
So the edge is with the White House on this one, because what will Boehner do? Will he satisfy the Tea Party? Will he then take this to the brink again? And then will he blink? I think.
Well, this is an important question, because the president in his speech this morning, he said, OK, now this is done. Now let's get budget reconciliation going. Let's, you know, because the Senate passed a budget back in March 23rd and Boehner has refused to appoint conferees. So let's get a conference going and get a budget. Number one. Number two, let's pass this immigration legislation. And number three, let's pass a farm bill. All three of these things have been passed by the Senate. All three of them are waiting for the House of Representatives to act. And all three of them, I think, you give me your political analysis, but I think that virtually you'd have 100% of the Democrats, and all it takes is 17 Republicans. I think probably if they were just put up for an up or down vote, all three of those things would pass tomorrow morning.
Which is what Boehner finally did after 16 days. You
right.
know, so I think your theory has a lot of credibility to it.
So is he going to start governing like he's the Speaker of the entire House, like Nancy Pelosi did, and actually entertain suggestions from Democrats? She entertained, you know, legislation being proposed by Republicans. Or is he going to continue with this weird thing that he will not bring anything to the floor unless it can pass with entirely Republican votes?
And it's the old Hastert rule, this former speaker, which really doesn't even exist.
It's the Hastert rule on steroids, actually.
Never intended that way. Hastert's own mouth said that last week out of his own mouth.
Yeah, but the old Hastert rule was a majority of the Republican caucus has to support it. What Boehner has been doing is saying he wouldn't bring anything to the floor unless it could pass entirely with Republican votes.
Already with Republican votes. Yeah, he morphed that rule.
Right. Which gives the power to the Tea Party.
If you look at his personality, if you really look back at John Boehner, he was never meant to govern, and it's just a fact of life and personal feelings and attitudes in this business that makes law or not make law.
Yeah, so you agree with Nancy Pelosi, who said that if he were a woman, he would be considered the weakest speaker in the history of the country.
Oh, I believe that he is sitting as the weakest. When you look at the speakers, and Gingrich, he can't compare to Gingrich.
Yeah.
And I know Gingrich was, you know, nuclear in a sense, but really Boehner can't compare to Gingrich's style. Gingrich was willing to lose if he had to for, you know, what he did believe in, and
right.
whether one likes Newt or not, but John Boehner just was staff driven at this point in time to try to recalculate votes for Speaker, and I think he's lost them.
Wow.
That's what I believe.
What else is going on in the world, Bob?
Well, I want to mention Iran, because This is an amazing thing that's unfolding in Geneva.
And you know this stuff because you're the you were the only member of Congress who speaks Farsi.
Right. I lived in Iran, and I was a part of the back channel for President Clinton more than Bush, because Bush's people blew 8 years ago what President Obama is doing now. They literally blew it with an agreement they could have had. But this is not to say we trust the Iranians, but this is an amazing step where they're actually getting down to discussions of how they get to a safer nuclear situation with Iran. Now, George Bush came out the other day and said, well, you know, they have to prove it first. Well, he said that for 8 years, and we really didn't get anywhere. So I just wanted to mention what the administration is doing in Iran, I think, is very substantive.
Yeah, very, very interesting. Okay, I'm going to have to dig into that one. Bob Nay with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com, brought to you by goatsfortheoldgoat.com. Be sure and check out Bob's book, Sideswiped. Bob, thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Tom.
Good talking with you, as always. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey, friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. EdisonFactor.com. EdisonFactor is a supplement for the brain. More information at EdisonFactor.com. SolarWorld.com. SolarWorld has a 35-year history in the manufacturing of solar in America. More information at SolarWorld.com. Carbonite.com. Automatic online backup and file recovery. More information at Carbonite.com. AngiesList.com. Detailed reviews on roofers, plumbers, house cleaners, dentists, and more. More information at AngiesList.com. Stamps.com. Postage online from your computer. More information at Stamps.com. And our website, TomHartman.com. You support our programs, and please help by supporting the people who help make this program possible. There are links to all of our underwriters at TomHartman.com. Thank you.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you in the chat room, Lady Jazz 2010. Tom, there you go, those nasty facts again. Don't do that to your guests. Oh, my. Anyway, it's Thursday, so I get my 2 minutes of science. So let's get geeky on the power of plants. We all know that the planet is continuing to warm as more and more greenhouse gases like carbon dioxide are released into the atmosphere each and every day. But while the situation today looks bleak, it could be even worse if it wasn't for plants and trees. That's because according to new research from scientists at Princeton University, plants and trees have absorbed billions of tons of carbon, especially over the last 60 years, that otherwise would have been released into our atmosphere, causing our planet to become red hot. But it wasn't always this way. Between the 1860s and the 1950s, and it's amazing. You go back in when we lived in Vermont, you know, all these forests, we look at all these forests, we think, whoa, look at these forests, these old trees. No, these are, it's almost impossible to find a virgin forest in the United States. And most trees are less than 200 years old. Most of them are less than 100 years old. When we lived in Vermont, I had all these pictures of Montpelier and the areas around it. Not a tree on all the mountains. I mean, all these mountains had been totally logged. So between the 1860s and the 1950s, this was the norm, deforestation and logging. And as a result, a lot of carbon got released into the environment instead of being trapped and absorbed by the trees. But in the 1950s, we started using land differently. We started planting more trees and plants. In part, this was from the experience with the Dust Bowl, where we discovered, and this is, you know, FDR put people, this the whole Civilian Conservation Corps, our deforestation, our agriculture practices were causing dust storms. And so the solution, plant trees. So plants overtook many environments that were previously barren and began absorbing billions of tons of carbon. And according to the researchers, just since the mid-20th century, Earth's land-based carbon sink, right, which is the plants and trees that capture carbon, has kept 186 to 192 billion tons of carbon out of our atmosphere. That's amazing when you think about it. I mean, from the Industrial Revolution until today, we've only burned 350 billion tons of carbon, And if 192 billion tons of that has been kept in by plants, then, you know, it's amazing. I mean, just if that carbon sink had not been in place and our planet's ecosystems had remained carbon makers instead of takers, they would have instead generated 65 to 82 billion tons of carbon on top of the carbon they wouldn't have absorbed. In total, that comes out to 250 to 270 roughly billion additional tons of carbon in the atmosphere if it wasn't for the plants and trees. And those numbers would have pushed current carbon dioxide concentrations to 485 parts per million, which is far worse. I mean, we're just over 400 now, far worse than the scientifically accepted threshold of 450, which is the point at which our climate tips and drastically and irreversibly changes. These findings show how important it is that foliage be taken into account, plants, when we talk about future global warming trends. And the findings make it clear that if we don't do anything to reduce greenhouse gas and carbon emissions in our atmosphere, we're going to need a lot more plants and trees to pick up the slack and maintain Earth's carbon sink. You know, for more on the dangers of climate change and global warming and all that kind of stuff, go over to lasthours.org and check out our new documentary, Last Hours. This is this was a labor of love that we've worked on for the last almost a year, put this thing together. And I think you'll find it really, really interesting. Lasthours.org. But basically, the bottom line is that we started emitting carbon in a serious way in the 1850s, 1860s. The first commercial oil well was drilled in 1865 in Titusville, Pennsylvania, by Colonel Drake. And, I mean, we were already using oil to some extent at that point. It had been, hadn't been wells. It had been pools and ponds. But we were using mostly a lot of coal. But the Industrial Revolution, oil, it was the perfect storm. And from 1850 to today, we have burned 350 billion tons of carbon and thrown that into the atmosphere as carbon dioxide. 350 billion tons. And more than half of that was absorbed by trees growing because we stopped deforestation. Now, there's a really interesting coincidence here. I remember when I was living in Vermont and I saw these old pictures and paintings and drawings, but they had some of the early photographs, you know, the daguerreotypes and the early 19th century, the 1900s, the 19-teens, the 1920s, the photography was actually starting to get pretty good. And you find all these old pictures, you know, of Vermont, and it's like the whole state was just naked. And in fact, the main thing, after they took all the trees out in the early 19th century, then the sheep farmers moved in. And the whole state was mostly sheep pasture. People, you know, they made mutton and wool. So I was asking the question, because we had started buying land. We had this house way out in the middle of the woods, and there was a couple of large lots of wooded land that came available contiguous with it that were relatively startlingly inexpensive. We ended up owning, I think, 400 acres of Vermont forest land at one point. And it was all forested. And Louise and I would go out on these long walks in the woods. This was after we had sold the ad agency in Atlanta and before we started the radio show. And so I was just writing books, and I had the time to go out and take a long walk. We'd get lost. I mean, it was just wonderful. But anyhow, I asked a couple of people who understood the history of the state, why do we have forests now? Why was it naked then? What made the difference? Why did we stop cutting those trees and start letting them grow back? And the answer was coal. The reason the state was denuded is the same reason Rome did this, and they wiped out so many trees that they ended up, this is why the Roman Empire started to expand, was because they ran out of wood, they ran out of firewood, is we were using wood as our primary energy source. We were using wood to power locomotives. You look at the old pictures of locomotives from the 1850s, 1860s, 1870s, the car, the fuel car behind the locomotive was filled with logs of wood. We were using wood to power steam engines. We were using wood to heat houses. And then we got really good at digging coal out of the ground, and the railroad lines got laid all the way up to Vermont, finally in about 1880, 1890. And when the railroad lines got laid up to Vermont in the 1890s, they were able to bring coal up from the coal mines down in West Virginia and in Pennsylvania. And when they brought the coal up, coal is much more efficient at producing heat than wood, so a much smaller amount of coal is necessary to warm your house, and people started building bigger houses. And you see around 1880, 1890, 1900, suddenly the house size in Vermont doubled, and people stopped logging the forests, and the forests came back. And this wasn't just Vermont. I mean, this was all over the country this was happening. So what's interesting is that during this time that we started throwing carbon into the air, from the 1850s to today, during this time, from 1850 until, well, really from 1870, 1880, up until the 1950s, we were also starting to grow back our forests, and then we started aggressively growing them back after the 30s, so into the 50s. The forests started getting big enough and old enough that they were really soaking up this carbon. So that 350 billion tons of carbon that we've put into the atmosphere that's raised our temperature 1 degree Celsius, half of it is now in those young trees, those 100-year-old trees. But we're not, you know, reforesting any new lands. So I think this is looking like a curve, you know.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
It's like that kind of J curve, that spike, because the trees are, you know, not expanding faster than our carbon production. And welcome back. And let's see here. Marcia in Englewood, Florida. Hey, Marcia, what should we do to help the Democrats?
Hi, Tom.
Thanks for watching Free Speech TV, Marcia.
There was something that I kept screaming at these Democrats about while I was listening to them on C-SPAN.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm thinking to myself, why are they all being so stubborn? Why is such a small minority of Republicans, the Tea Party, mm-hmm. being able to get the rest of the more logical? And I used to disagree with you terribly about, you know, there are good Republicans. I used to think to myself, you got to be nuts, you know. There's no such thing as a good Republican. You're right. There are good Republicans, but they were terrified, and they were held hostage also by the Tea Party.
Yep.
By the threat of being primaried.
Yep.
So I'm thinking to myself, how are you going to overcome, you know, the bad being a small amount of bad being able to cripple a large amount of good people?
Mm-hmm.
And I thought to myself, you got to negotiate. Leave out the Tea Party. Go to the good, GOP, the good Republicans, the old-time Republicans that do actually care about the country, and say, look, if you're worried about being primaried, I'll give you whatever support you want to counter it. And I think that's how they need to deal with it.
Yeah, but the problem is that we need to be supporting progressive Democrats, too, and Greens, and, you know, it's like...
We do, but we need to keep our country up and running.
Yeah. You know, in a state where you've got open primaries, and it's about half the states where you don't have to be registered with a party in order to vote in either party's primary, it would make a lot of sense to vote in the Republican primaries for the most rational, least insane Republican, and try to repopulate the party with rational people. And it might even make sense if the Democratic Party has their act together in your particular congressional district and you're happy with whoever it looks like is going to get elected in the primary, to re-register as a Republican just to vote in the Republican primary to do that. Because the Tea Partiers have, you know, they've taken over the Republican, you know, and the party in a lot of areas, in a lot of precincts. And they do it by becoming precinct committee persons. This thing that I've been, you know, harping on for 3 years here, when I first discovered that they were doing it, and I saw the Concord Coalition's YouTube, instructional YouTubes, and how you too can help take over the Republican Party for Tea Partiers, you know. And it was like, you know, Democrats, progressives need to do the same thing with the Democratic Party. We need to show up and say, hey, we're here. We're going to join the party and make the decisions about who gets to run on the primary ballot. But I think that there's something to what you're saying, Marcia, as much as my first instinct is to say, help Republicans. No.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking. But I'm thinking what's happening now isn't working.
Yeah. Well, and this is why occasionally, you know, a Republican, or mostly I get Tea Partiers who call in and want to debate me on the air, but occasionally I'll get a rational Republican who will call in and say, you know, I disagree with most of what you say, but I agree with this, let's talk about that. And then I always ended up by saying, well, you know, please get involved in your local Republican Party, because we need, you know, my dad was a rational Republican. We need rational Republicans in America. This, the fate of our republic is at stake. Marcia, thank you for the call. It's very thought-provoking. Well said. We'll be right back. 20 minutes past. Tom Hartman here with you. And once again, if you'd like to speak with our previous guest, Peter Morrissey, his Twitter is at P Morrissey, M-O-R-I-C-I, number one. He specifically asked me to be sure to promote his Twitter feed, so there you go. And tell him I said hi. It was nice having a reasonable conversation. Mark in San Francisco. Hey, Mark. Thanks for you're listening on our website, TomHartman.com. Thank you. What's up?
How you doing?
I'm great, but I'll get better. How about you?
Sounds good to me.
Okay.
I want to bring up the fact, Tom, that I think that the Democrats need to really push the message of income inequality, and that's the issue that they want to address as a party, and undo Reaganomics, and really say that it's been a failure, and it's devastated the middle class, and also that, you know, the American people have a credit card that they're defaulting on. They, you know, the Republicans want a message that, oh, it's our debt. Well, the middle class has a debt, and it's from Reaganomics.
Yeah, I totally agree with you, Mark. The problem that we have is that there are so many, in a cynical moment, I would call them Bill Clinton Democrats. But, you know, Bill Clinton did a fair amount of good stuff, too. But there are so many Democrats who agree with transnational corporations running our trade policy, who agree with taxes on the rich being below 50%. They're sort of Reagan Democrats, and they pretty much control the institutional Democratic Party. And that's why I think that that's why I know that the Democratic Party, even though they would win, if they started basically echoing Bernie Sanders, channeling Bernie Sanders tomorrow, the Democratic Party would never again lose an election. You consider the one time in the history of our republic, at least recent history, since World War II, that the issue of our national trade policy and our national industrial policy, the one time that it has been litigated on the national stage was when Ross Perot ran against both Bill Clinton and George Herbert Walker Bush in the election of 1992. And in that election, if I'm remembering my years right, I'm pretty sure it was 92. And in that election, Ross Perot pulled about 20% of the American vote. And he had a guy who was his running mate who seemed like he had dementia. And Ross Perot was kind of a wackadoodle on other issues. He really didn't, you know, he started going off on these paranoid rants about how they were trying to, you know, ruin his daughter's wedding and stuff. And it was just very, very strange. But he still got 20% of the vote because so many Americans are saying free trade. No, we don't want no stinking free trade. And just that simple thing, you know, that Sherrod Brown will talk about in the Senate, you know, the Democrat, Bernie Sanders will talk about, Jan Schakowsky will talk about, Alan Grayson will talk about, the Progressive Caucus, you know, Raul Grijalva and those guys will talk about, but the institutional Democratic Party will not discuss. And that's why I think that we need to, you know, people who are progressives who genuinely believe, you know, and frankly, I think that there's a lot of conservatives who think our trade policies stink, should get inside their political parties. They should run for precinct committee person and like that. Is that, am I making sense, Mark?
Yes, you are. And one thing, Tom, you know, when we go into these budget talks, you know, the Republicans are going to say that it's about the debt. And the Democrats need to say, no, we're in here to do what we were sent here to do, and that's bring some fairness to the middle class of the American people and go in with that message and also lay out, you know, have a laundry list of our demands, like taking, you know, Wall Street tax them and take the cap off Social Security and say that Social Security is more important than ever because of what happened with people's pensions.
Yes, because of the theft of pensions, during the Reagan administration, they changed the rules on pensions and made it possible for corporations to steal pension funds. In fact, the guy I had dinner with last night had that happen to him. He'd worked 25 years at a place, and he had a pretty good pension. He was all set to retire, and one of these Bain Capital kind of companies came in and sucked up the company, spun it off, dumped it into another company, dumped all the debt into it, took the pension to pay off the debt, and then laid off everybody and shut it down. And, you know, the fat cacks walked, the Mitt Romneys of that company walked off with hundreds of millions of dollars, and he got screwed. He got laid off. And it was just an amazing story. Guy sitting right across the table from me telling me the story of exactly what, you know, how it happened. And this happened like 8 or 10 years ago. But
we need Social Security now more than ever because of what happened there, Tom.
You bet. You bet. Mark, thanks a lot for the call. I appreciate it. John in Cayucos, California.
Hey, Tom. Yeah, it's me.
Hey, what's up?
At least the first 7 seconds to tell a geeky Science Thursday joke. What did the girl mushroom say to the boy mushroom?
I don't know what.
Are you a fun guy?
Ha! That's a good one.
I have a drum and a cymbal.
Yeah.
Anyway, I
boom.
That's like a good clean joke for the kids.
Yeah, there you go.
But anyway. I have an acronym and a bumper sticker for what we're going through here with Republicans. I call it strife economics.
Yes.
And because we are in strife, when you think about it, if you look up the definition, we are in strife. And the strife stands for sick and tired of Republicans inflicting fiscal emergencies.
Wow. And you're good at acronyms, John.
Exactly what's happening.
Yeah. Okay.
I hope that we can get through this and not go through this in 3 months.
Yeah, I'm totally with you.
It's going to happen again. I think we all know it's going to happen again.
I would not put bets on it one way or the other right now, which is not a good thing. So I'm with you. John, thanks a lot for the call. We're going to hit a break here in about 15 seconds, but just a quick Higgins alert. Against the advice of the vet, Louise put Higgins on antibiotics. 3 days ago, 4 days ago, something like that, last Sunday. And last night we got home, walked onto the boat, and there was Higgins walking around going, meow, meow, meow. And he has not been up walking around in a week. I mean, we were last weekend having a serious conversation about, are we going to have to put this cat down? Because he was so weak, so sick, and looked like he was in pain. And so it looks like, you know, $1,000 worth of veterinary visits, and the vet was just wrong. Although we'll see. I mean, it might be that the infection is on top of cancer or something. God only knows. But so far, Higgins seems to be doing well. Knock wood. I shouldn't brag about it. I don't want to jinx it. We'll be right back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
So, I mean, there's a lot of problems in the world, but, you know, if you got a moment to send a few good vibes to this little orange cat, Higgins, up his way, I'd appreciate it. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Let's see. The Jotnar were the enemy gods to the Aesir and the Vanir. Interesting. Norwegian. We have a conversation in the chat room about Norwegian gods. I'm telling you, smartest people on earth. Anyhow, welcome back. And it's the last half hour of our show today, and I'm wondering why it is that even to this day, even after it's all over with, the media has not come clean about the fact that John Boehner could have ended the government shutdown on the first day, could have prevented it for that matter, by simply allowing, actually they changed the rules so Eric Cantor would have to allow it, but by simply allowing the House of Representatives to vote on whether or not to fund the government. Really simple. Just put the vote out.
He could have done it.
And he didn't. And that long New York Times article that we talked about at some length last week, where there was this backroom conspiracy meeting. I think I might even have it. Yeah, here we are. I've got it in my keeper stack. It was by Cheryl Gay Stolberg and Mike McIntyre, and it was titled "A Federal Budget Crisis: Months in the Planning." And it starts out shortly after President Obama. This is New York Times. On October 5th, shortly after President Obama started his second term, a loose-knit coalition of conservative activists led by former Attorney General Edwin Meese III gathered in the Capitol to plot strategy. Their push to repeal Mr. Obama's health care law was going nowhere, and they desperately needed a new plan. Out of that session, held one morning in a location the members insist on keeping secret, came a little notice, quote, "Blueprint to Defunding Obamacare," end quote, signed by Mr. Meese and leaders of more than three dozen conservative groups. It articulated a take-no-prisoners legislative strategy that had long percolated in conservative circles, that Republicans could derail the health care overhaul if conservative lawmakers were willing to push fellow Republicans, including their cautious leaders, into cutting off financing for the entire federal government. And they quote the guy from the Heritage Action for the part of the Heritage Foundation. He says, basically, we can pull this off. They know, to most of us, the shutdown came out of nowhere, but quoting from the New York Times, but interviews with a wide array of conservatives show that the confrontation that precipitated the crisis was the outgrowth of a long-running effort. Ed Meese led this thing. Ed Meese, for those of you who don't know, and I shared this a week ago when this article, 2 weeks, I guess October 5th is now 2 weeks ago, right? When this article first came out, Ed Meese was the Reagan Attorney General who convened the Meese Commission on Pornography to find out if pornography actually hurts your brain, if pornography is capable of making people crazy. And Ed Meese and his staff watched hundreds of hours of porn, child porn, snuff porn, S&M, BD, whatever. I don't know all the. Anyhow, all this kind of porn. And they concluded, yes, it warps your mind. And tried to put that into law. Well, in fact, I think they actually did put it into law. I think that's when the first anti-child porn laws came about. And maybe snuff porn, I'm not sure. But so apparently his brain really was bent. I mean, maybe the shutdown of our government that just happened was caused by pornography. You think it's possible? I mean, is this the ultimate evidence? Somebody, quick, call Los Angeles. Stop the porn industry. Because they twisted Ed Meese's brain to the point where he came up with this idea that was totally nuts, and look at what it's done. But this was right after Obama started his second term. You'll remember the day that Obama started his first term, there was a similar meeting to this one at the Caucus Room restaurant. And Jim DeMint was there, who's now running the Heritage Foundation. And Paul Ryan was there, ran for vice president. But this was back in 2009. Paul Ryan ran for vice president in 2012. Back in 2009, Paul Ryan, in this meeting, saying, as Pete Sessions said, we're going to become the Taliban against this black guy in the White House. Can't have that. Actually, none of them expressed the racism that I just expressed. But I truly believe that for some of these men, not all of them, but that for some of these men, and they were all men. And did you notice, by the way, and it was pointed out by several people, that it was women who brokered the deal to put the government back on track, Republican and Democratic women. But that these men were plotting to take down the president. I'm from day one. Taliban. We're going to be the Taliban. I don't think any president has ever had to deal with this kind of thing before. I mean, they were rough on Bill Clinton, but And you know why they were rough on Bill Clinton? This gets back to my thing about racism and misogyny. Bill Clinton's big sin in the mind of conservatives, and those of you who are old enough to remember the Clinton presidency, you know that I am telling the truth here. Bill Clinton's big sin in the mind of conservatives was that he put his wife in charge, a woman, in charge of writing health care legislation for the United States. They called it Hillary Care, and they attacked Hillary mercilessly. And after he did that, when he put his wife in charge of coming up with health care policy for the United States, that's when the misogynists came out of the woodwork. And I'm telling you, misogyny in this country, the hatred of women, that's a fancy word for the hatred of women. Misogyny in this country is stronger as a political force than is racism. And racism is a damn strong political force. But Barack Obama was able to overcome that. We will see if we can overcome misogyny in the 2016 election. But I sure hope that Elizabeth Warren or Hillary Clinton or both are on the ticket. I think that would be spectacular. Anyhow, enough of my ramblings. Bob in Hastings, Michigan. Hey, Bob, what's on your mind?
Hi, Tom. I love your show. We listen every day.
Thank you.
Free speech. But I was just posting on Justin Amash's Facebook page.
Is he your congressman?
He's my congressman.
Oh, man, you have my sympathy.
Thank you. I appreciate it. Yes, he's something. I posted on his Facebook page that his vote was irresponsible and reckless.
Mm-hmm.
And what really struck me is the depth of support he has here in West Michigan. But then you grew up not far from here. You know how West Michigan can be.
Oh, yeah, and my grandparents and all my cousins lived in Newego and just north of Grand Rapids, and I spent my summers there. I know West Michigan really well. And
yes.
Holland, Newego, Grand Rapids.
My
brother lives in Lowell.
Okay, yeah. Well, the depth of support, I'm in Hastings.
Yeah.
The depth of support for Justin Amash in West Michigan here is quite something. His supporters are unchastened by these recent events.
Yep.
And the response is, although I was amazed at how many likes I got in my post on his Facebook page.
Right.
But they still believe default is the only solution to this country's budget problems. And they accuse me of being brain dead, and they accuse me of not knowing math, and not understanding simple math.
Wow.
And, so I think in a few months, at least if Justin has anything to say about it, this issue will be back.
It will not surprise me at all. The base has not been satisfied. I mean, I'll come out and say I think it's going to take a crash. We are going to experience an economic crisis in this country that will bring about a progressive renaissance. I truly believe that, but I'm not hoping for it, and I'm not working to make it happen. If anything, I'm trying to stop it. I'm saying, if we changed our trade policies right now, if we roll back the Reagan tax cuts and rolled back the fast-track free trade deals that really started with Nixon but Reagan put on steroids, if we just undid those two things, we could avoid a crash, we could put our economy back on track, we'd bring back several, 6, 8, 10 million jobs to the United States, unemployment would go down to functionally zero, down to 2-3%, like it was during the Great Prosperity. And this country could work. I've been calling for that. The last book I wrote was Rebooting the American Dream. It was just, here's how we do it. Please, let's do it. And Bernie Sanders read from that on the floor of the Senate when he did his filibuster. But, I'll say it's probably tough stuff is going to happen, but I'm not going to make it happen. I mean, Justin Amash and these other Tea Partiers, they're like, we're going to make it happen. It's like, this is scary stuff, Bob.
It is scary, and his Facebook page is instructive for anybody who wants to see what's going on in his mind and in his supporters' mind.
Yeah, and I'm guessing that is true of probably all of the Tea Party freshmen, all the Tea Party members of the House of Representatives, and Ted Cruz, and what's his lapdog's name? The little guy who follows him around from Utah? Mike Lee. That's right. Ted Cruz and Mike Lee. Bob, thanks a lot for the call. We'll be back with more right after this.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
John Kenneth Galbraith said, "The modern conservative is engaged in one of man's oldest exercises in moral philosophy, the search for a superior moral justification for selfishness." Welcome back. And Willina in Tarpley, Texas. How are you?
Hello. Hello. First time call.
Oh, well, thank you.
I've listened to your... Listen to your guest. I love listening to that. I'm a political junkie.
Welcome to the tribe.
But my, thank you, Mr. Hartman.
Mm-hmm.
I have been listening, watching C-SPAN since day one of the shutdown, and I got a good look at the political process.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I'm not a Republican. I'm not a Democrat. I'm independent. I try to see sides on all around. And before I continue, I just want to tell you that Ted Cruz, his father must have been Dr. Zeus.
Mm.
And now he's called Thing One and Thing Two.
Oh, yeah. Dr. Zeus.
Yeah. Okay.
There you go.
Because his filibuster was on green eggs and ham, right?
That's right. Yeah.
Okay. All right. So now I watched the Senate legislation last night, okay, about the bill about putting our government back to work.
Mm-hmm.
And they listed, Pelosi and all that listed and did a lot of praising the Senate Majority Leader.
Harry Reid?
Mitch.
Oh, Mitch McConnell, the Senate Minority Leader.
Right. Okay, and so they went. So the bill went to the House, and I watched the House last night.
Mm-hmm.
I was very disappointed that any Republican that voted no, okay, would like to take America down.
Yeah.
Then also was included in that legislation last night that I just could not believe was that a 2.9 billion dam was voted on and passed for the Ohio River, Kentucky, and Illinois.
Right, and this was so Mitch McConnell could put some money in his district, in his state, and get reelected. It was an earmark for Mitch McConnell.
It's an outrage.
And
it wasn't even mentioned. It wasn't even mentioned on any of the news today.
Yeah, you're right.
I
forgot to mention it, actually. It's just, I guess we're all so used to members of Congress, you know, sticking these earmarks in. But you're right. It is an outrage, and it should be highlighted. Thank you for pointing it out.
Okay. Here, we were on our knees, and then some. And I'm also ex-military brat and a divorced military wife. And our guys are still fighting over there, and then our veterans, who don't even have a chance, they get treated with a vet mobile unit.
Mm-hmm.
And here, we were on our knees and everything, and Mitch McConnell gets a dam for his country.
Right, and apparently that was the only way Harry Reid could get him to go along with the deal, was to give him a couple million dollars for a dam in Kentucky. It's Willina, you're absolutely right. That is an amazing and tragic commentary on the state of American politics. Thank you so much for the call. Thanks for watching Free Speech TV. We'll be right back. Before the hour, Tom Harbin here with you, and got a lot of calls in just about 8-9 minutes here to cover them, so let's try to be brief. I'll try to be brief, too. Amy in North Las Vegas, Nevada. Hey, Amy, what's up?
Hi. Yeah, I was thinking about the entitlement and printing money.
Mm-hmm.
It seems to me that, you know, well, personally, I know a lot of people don't think so, but the world is very overpopulated. The whole world is.
Sure.
And first of all, I also wanted to say that entitlement, I heard on TV, it's not a racial issue. People always pack like it's a racial issue. Apparently there are more, if even with all the Spanish people and the black people, there are more white people receiving welfare type.
That is true, and it always has been true.
Yeah. So anyway, what I wanted to say was that, you know, about the printing of the money, everyone says, oh, we can't be doing that. But, you know, the more people we have on the planet or in our country, the more money we need.
That's right. That's why a gold standard is a crazy idea.
Yeah. I mean, the whole theory of economics is sort of off because the more people you have, the more money you need in circulation. And if you have more people and there are jobs, and in reality we do. You know, there aren't jobs out there that desperately need to be done, and people aren't doing them. You know what I'm saying? So people need, you know, we need their money printed up. And I understand that people that work hard for a living and have to give all this money in taxes, that's not right. It's not the right system to do
it. No, we need a more progressive system. Amy, thank you for listening on Cable Radio Network and CRN, and thank you for your comments. Excellent. Well said. Ben in Chicago, Illinois. Hey, Ben.
Hey, how you doing, Mr. Hartman?
Great. Tom, it's fine.
Thanks. Yesterday I tried calling about your new words for the capitalism for Walmart and McDonald's.
Uh-huh. You got one?
I got a couple. The first one is just kind of catchy. I heard the one yesterday about capitalism.
Uh-huh.
I'm thinking McCrapitalism.
McCrapitalism, okay.
And the other one was Cthulhu capitalism, in that it's terrible and people are consciously ignorant of it, and then when you find out about it, you either go insane or die.
Uh-huh. Okay. All right. Great. Ben, thank you very much for those. That's two great contributions. Ken in Geneva, Illinois. Hey, Ken.
Hi, Tom. Like your program.
Thank you.
About 40 or 50 years ago, there was a scholar talking about Nostradamus. Excuse me. And I didn't pay a lot of attention to him. He had two things that he said. One was that the United States was going to invade another country. And I thought, you know, this is crazy. Mm. And then the second thing was that we were going to be invaded from the inside, not from the outside. We didn't have anything to worry about being invaded from another country from the outside.
Yeah. Was that there was a big fad in the late 60s, early 70s of Nostradamus books. Was that Hal Lindsey? He wrote Late Great Planet Earth. That wasn't Nostradamus, though, was it? Or am I?
I don't know. And I got a couple of books. And
it was around that time. But anyhow, so your question was, Ken.
He's a little hard to understand.
Yeah.
I was trying to find out what happened after that, if there was any other prediction.
Here's the thing. I've actually read Nostradamus' original quatrains. I've never read them in the original French. I don't speak that, but I've read them in English translations, both older and newer English translations. And I would encourage you to actually read some of the actual quatrains, because they are impenetrable. They are so dense, they are so ambiguous, that generation after generation after generation of people have interpreted them to their own times in some, you know, ways very similar to how the Revelation of John is done. Oh, he's obviously talking about so-and-so. You know, the name of the beast is 777. Well, there's seven letters in Ronald, there's seven letters in Wilson, and there's seven letters in Reagan. So Reagan's name was 777. So he must be the beast. Gorbachev, he has the mark of the horn of the beast on his forehead, and Gorbachev had that birthmark. Oh, he must be the one who interacts with the beast and all that. So every generation, you know, it's like a Rorschach test, because it's sufficiently ambiguous. So that's my take on Nostradamus, Ken. I'm a little skeptical, but thanks for the call and raising the issue. Martha in Carrboro, North Carolina. Hey, Martha.
Hi.
You want to talk about the Tea Party?
What?
You wanted to talk about the Tea Party?
Yeah, I just want to say, I think that it's a new idea. We ought to target the 22 states, okay, that are not going for affordable care.
Right.
Because I think a lot of those people are full of hate. And hate, psychologists tell us, is the condition that harms the person.
Yes.
So we need a program. This is just in addition to everything you and Mike and everybody does, a program that really says, we're going to help you get over your hatred for Obama and other people. And then you can look at the information, you see.
Yeah.
They're not going to look at the information now, as long as I am and all that hate.
I am completely with you, Martha. We need a healing in this country, a reconciliation. A lot of us hoped that electing a black president would do it, but instead what it did, I think for some it was a healing thing, but for others it just brought out even more hatred. It's really sad. Martha, it speaks to the mental illness of America that needs to be treated. Carol in Clawson, Michigan. Hey, Carol.
Yeah. Hey, Tom. My husband George and I have a nomination for the capitalism.
He okay.
End times capitalism.
End times capitalism. That's a
end
great
times.
One.
Because that's what it feels like.
Yeah.
Secondly, piggybacking on your discussion of trees, I was listening to a man on Michigan NPR explain how those lovely, brilliant orange, yellows, and reds that you and I remember from Michigan childhood, because
yeah.
I'm from here as well.
Yep.
It's not only a matter now of knowing when to look for them, but where, because they are disappearing, especially from the Upper Peninsula.
Yeah, because the weather patterns
yep.
are changing and the trees aren't
yep.
moving fast enough to keep up with the changing weather patterns.
Yeah.
So they,
yeah,
yeah it is. Go ahead.
Thirdly, I took my dad to a doctor's appointment today, and through background conversation, the gentleman there, 92, whose daughter, approximately our age, informed her father that he would have to change his Medigap insurance, you know, because of that Obamacare.
Oh, my.
He volunteered at 92 to take his 38 revolver to Washington to shoot the president, but that would be okay.
Oh, no. Oh, no. Carol, I'm sorry we're out of time, but thank you for that story. That's pretty grim stuff. I mean, that's the craziness. That anyhow, tomorrow is Anything Goes Friday. We can talk about pretty much anything you want. And don't forget, democracy is not a spectator sport. It starts with you. Get active. And here's something you can get active about. Go to lasthours.org and watch our little 10-minute video. Lasthours.org. Tag your it.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to tomhartman.com.
Hey friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. EdisonFactor.com. Edison Factor is a supplement for the brain. More information at EdisonFactor.com. SolarWorld.com. Solar World has a 35-year history in the manufacturing of solar in America. More information at SolarWorld.com. Carbonite.com. Automatic online backup and file recovery. More information at Carbonite.com. AngiesList.com. Detailed reviews on roofers, plumbers, house cleaners, dentists, and more. More information at AngiesList.com. Stamps.com. Postage online from your computer. More information at Stamps.com. And our website, TomHartman.com. You support our programs, and please help by supporting the people who help make this program possible. There are links to all of our underwriters at TomHartman.com. Thank you.